Good afternoon. I would like to call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. Today is Friday, February 12th. Let the record reflect that it is 1:34. Apologize for the delay. We were waiting for Senator Schauer to call on the line. So with that, we're going to say who's present today. First of all, Senator Keel, thank you for being here. And Senator Hughes, thank you for being here. We just want to remind people to turn their cell phones off if they have them on. We want to thank Nancy Hemingway, of course. Thank you for all you do for us. And Alex, thank you. You've been an excellent support person in this room. And I also want to point out Jake. Jake, thank you, and Terrence. We have a special committee aide today. It's first time Aaron Weaver is going to be a committee aide. Kelly is gone for a short time on a family emergency. And I want to thank Lisa for stepping up, too, to help us. So you guys, lots of teamwork going on behind the scenes, and I really want to express how grateful I am and our office is for your support. Today, we only have one item on the agenda today, is a selection and review of judges, Senate Bill 14. We will be hearing invited and some public testimony calls in today because I left it open. And so first of all, we're going to have Nancy Mead, the Ledge Liaison to the Alaska Court System. So Ms. Mead, if you could come before us, please. And you know what to do. You know the routine. And I think did I give you 10 minutes? Is that what I gave you? 10 minutes? I can't remember. Did I say 5 or 10? I can't remember. I think it was 10 minutes. Okay. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Is this the mic? Can you hear me?
No, we can barely hear you.
Okay. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Nancy Mead. I'm the General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. As you all know, I am here to testify in opposition to this bill at the direction of the Supreme Court. We're normally neutral on bills and avoid taking a position, but Senate Bill 14 fits that exception for a bill that would materially affect the administration of justice, and I'd like to go through those ways. In a nutshell, In the court's view, this bill will undermine the independence of the judiciary and the public's trust in the court system, and it will also hinder our ability to handle cases effectively and fairly, and in a few concrete ways. First, I want to make clear that I'm speaking for the Alaska court system, not the other two entities that reside in the judicial branch, the Judicial Council and the Commission on Judicial Conduct. The courts rely on those two entities and highly value their work, but they are separate, and I know that their directors are online ready to give their own testimony about the way that this bill would impact their operations. Very briefly, it's the council currently that screens applicants for judgeships to make sure that they're highly qualified individuals suited to be a judge, and performs analyses and provides information when a judge is standing for retention in an election, as provided in the Constitution and statutes. The Commission, on the other hand, is solely responsible and only responsible for ensuring that judges adhere to the highest judicial ethical standards as reflected in the Code of Judicial Conduct that the judges must and do follow strictly. And as I'll explain briefly, this bill would move and change many of those duties, but specific questions about those duties would be better directed at those individuals. So I'll try to highlight the most severe impacts we see if this bill should pass. The first issue, the major concerns that the court system has with this bill appear in Section 12 and 14, and those concern how empty seats on the Court of Appeals, that's Section 12, and the District Court and in Magistrate positions, that's Section 14, are filled when a judge leaves state service. And I'm going to talk about what the bill does regarding magistrates separately later, because that involves really novel and overarching revisions that are a little bit separate from what happens with judges. So these sections make really substantial changes. They take our model for judicial selection that's worked well since statehood, what's considered the gold standard merit selection process that's enshrined in our Constitution for the Supreme and Superior Courts, and replaces it with an entirely different way of seating judges, a way that necessarily will make politics and political affiliation a key factor for seating judges. Under this bill, the current merit system for naming judges would basically be replaced with the system you see used in Washington, D.C. And because the court system has seen that the D.C. system puts judges squarely in the middle of party politics and that it can be slow and subject to gamesmanship and even in many situations unfair, we're opposed to moving our branch of government closer to that D.C. model. Right now, and as long as the courts have existed, lawyers who want to be a judge apply through the Judicial Council. The council goes through an incredibly thorough, multi-step process for gathering input from multiple sources about that person. They analyze every piece of information about the applicant that they can unearth, the person's legal analytical skills, suitability of past experience, respect afforded by their peers, character traits such as humility, integrity, temperament, and fairness, among other information. They conduct interviews, they hold public hearings, and they finally identify who among the applicants is the highly qualified, are the highly qualified ones that could serve Alaskans as a judge. Those names are forwarded to the governor, who considers the names and does whatever research he or she wishes about those individuals at that level, and finally appoints the new judge. So instead of this system, the bill, and I'm looking specifically at page 5, lines 13 to 14, would allow the governor to appoint from that list of fully vetted and qualified names provided by the council, and the bill says, or to appoint one person who is not nominated but is qualified under a statute, and the statute there cited merely says the person has to be a U.S. citizen, an Alaska resident, a member of the bar who's practiced law for a certain number of years. So that's it. In other words, the governor could appoint pretty much any Alaska lawyer, whether or not that person has a high level of legal ability or suitable experience or integrity or has a background that some could find troubling. It can be anyone the governor chooses. Further, and closely related in those sections 12 and 14, it also says that the person the governor appoints must be confirmed by the legislature, just like a governor's cabinet member. So page 5, lines 15, and page 6, line 27, say that. But really, unlike cabinet members even, the bill says the person appointed can't take their seat until after confirmation. This is a built-in delay in seating judges that will very directly slow the progress of criminal cases, because these changes are to the courts that handle criminal appeals and also misdemeanors. These seats will remain vacant in some cases for up to a year, meaning there's a tangible, statutorily created delay in providing justice to Alaskans. And as you all know, the confirmation process can go smoothly or it can go badly, depending on the nature of the office being filled and the political dynamics surrounding that office and the appointee. Sometimes confirmations can be acrimonious or unfair. Just look at what happened with judicial confirmations in the United States Senate recently. Many of the steps required of an appointee who is seeking to be confirmed are incompatible with the judge's ability and duty to handle every new case with an open mind and base the decision solely on the existing law and facts that apply in the particular case. To make those neutral and fair decisions, a judge cannot, within the bounds of their code of ethics, have made commitments or representations about what they would do with any forthcoming issue. So with the governor able to appoint any attorney who has a certain number of years of practice and the legislative confirmation, the bill means that some appointees will never have gone through the thorough vetting process like the Judicial Council does now. The factors that allow a person to become a judge now, those excellent legal skills and distinguished reputation and judicious temperament, will change. They'll be replaced with factors that currently play no role whatsoever in the council's merit review, such as party registration and even possibly political contributions. Those will become much more important, both in the governor's appointment decision and in the legislature's confirmation process. I've heard from the sponsor staff at the past hearing that you need to rein in the judges somehow, because the judges are in fact political already, and because even though the courts covered in this bill don't have any jurisdiction over the social or political issues that seem to be causing concerns recently, the other two branches should just have more control over the judiciary. But I'll say that our system already works well. In the 60 plus years that Alaska's been a state, we've not had any judges involved in terrible public scandals or had to resign in disgrace. We have had some judges who've been disciplined for various transgressions, but none have been criminal in nature or due to uncovering something unsavory. And that clear record is a testimonial to the thorough and careful system where not just an applicant's credentials are examined, but really every aspect of that person's character and past. And there's no substitute for this. And the court system really does not see a reason to change it. Making these judges straight up gubernatorial appointees with confirmation has the potential that they'll be chosen like other appointees or cabinet members. Those with political alliances or a certain level of allegiance with the governor are the ones that will become judges. And before that's taken as a slight or perceived as anything negative whatsoever about whoever might be the governor or who would be the appointees, I think it makes sense to look realistically at how governor appointments and confirmations go. And if you would think that a governor Shower would appoint the same individuals to be judges as a Governor Keel would choose, then this makes sense. And would the appointees stand the same chance of being confirmed in this body if it were organized with a different majority? Obviously, it's how politics work, and that's perfectly okay and reasonable for boards and commissions and for the governor's own inside commissioners and advisor, because those individuals are intended to reflect a certain ideology and the legislature's political preferences. But for judges in the court system, a separate and equal branch of government with a mission based on neutrality and fairness that strives to be apart from politics, that system would be an infringement on our independence, and that's why we're opposing it. As far as the comment that the current system is political already, the best way I can respond is to emphasize that the goal the current system, and is explicitly discussed by the drafters of the Constitution, is to have as little political consideration as is humanly possible determine who becomes a judge. And if the complaint is that the current selection system is already political, the solution can't be to replace it with a system that is patently and inarguably even more political. When litigants appear in a courtroom, they should not feel disadvantaged or advantaged by whose side the judge is already on, based on the philosophy of the governor who appointed them. So this solution would certainly make judges political, so that new appointees would be even clearly and identifiably conservative or liberal, depending on the party of the governor and how a legislature organizes. So this undermining of the public trust in the administration could lead litigants to believe
Nancy,
that.
Nancy, it's been 10 minutes. I've already doubled your time from 5 to 10. And so we wanted 4 minutes or 5 minutes to ask questions. So if you would just wrap it up in a final minute or so, and then allow the committee, because we've got like 10 people online, and I'm actually going to allow some liberty for people that I know are opposing this bill to speak, and I want to give people online the opportunity.
Okay, given that I am limited in that way, let me just highlight the other problems that the court system has in the bill. It imposes a philosophical litmus test on those who would like to apply through the council and be recommended to the governor that is vague, probably impossible to implement, and will be a deterrent to people applying for judgeships. Its treatment of magistrates is really new. We have 38 magistrate positions that under this bill would become governor appointees. They have very limited jurisdiction. I can't imagine the justification for that. Magistrates don't handle big constitutional matters or matters with serious policy issues, and there is really no need to take all those positions and make them gubernatorial. And further, it will cause us to close some courts because the hurdles that this bill imposes on those positions will cause people not to apply for them. We already struggle to get applicants for many magistrate positions. And finally, the piece about moving all the retention evaluations to the commission is bad from the court system's point of view because it will dilute the focus of that ethics commission wholly on ethics and will cause that entity to no longer be 100% dedicated to judicial ethics, which we have valued in the past. And that's as fast as I can go, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And with that, I like you. We have about 3 minutes left to take questions, and we're going to start with Senator Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Mead, I would like, if you would follow up later with the courts that might be closed, the courts where there are problems finding magistrates. I have a question about the litmus test piece, and we have a lawyer in front of us, so It's an opportunity to ask. I mentioned this in a previous hearing. The terms seem at odds to me, and yet the Judicial Council under the bill would be bound to forward only people who agree to both. I think it's strict constitutionalism and abiding by legislative intent. Can you explain how you as an attorney see those two philosophies?
Through the chair to Senator Keel, the honest answer is that I can't. That is not wording that's used anywhere else in the legal realm that I am aware of or that I could find. I think it will be very difficult to implement. I don't think people will understand just what they're agreeing to. I've heard of strict constitutional interpretation, which means how a person interprets the Constitution. I don't know what constitutional interpretation of a statute or regulation means, and I will say that having strict interpretation of a statute, if that's what it's saying, and adhering to legislative intent very often contradict each other, and there are questions about what that would mean, how it would be applied, whether it could be implemented, and what a person would be agreeing to should they say that they agree.
Thank you.
Senator Hughes, do you have a question?
Senator Hughes? Yes, I do. Thank you for coming before us today, Nancy. I'm not surprised the courts is taking this position. Maintaining the status quo is always a lot more comfortable than change, and I understand that. I have to take note that those who convened to write our Constitution purposely did not include the Court of Appeals or magistrates in the Constitution this way, so it does leave it to statute. And I do take issue, I think in your opening comments you referred to, and maybe this wasn't the verb you used, but something regarding undermining the independence and the public trust of the judiciary branch. My experience since I've been serving in the legislature in various public meetings and town halls and meetings with individuals is a lot of distrust, actually, and concern that there is a lopsided situation here. Because when I think of the checks and balances in our U.S. Constitution and between the three branches and what we have here in our state, I see the back and forth between the executive and the legislature going both directions, and between the judiciary and the legislative branch, I kind of just see one way that we check and balance the judiciary branch. So correct me if I'm wrong, is when the judiciary branch puts forward its appropriation, and then we could adjust it or agree to it. Is there another way that we have a check and balance on the judiciary branch?
Through the chair to Senator Hughes, I would first say that the Constitution doesn't deal with the Court of Appeals and Magistrates because those didn't exist in 1959. So that's why I said what I did. With respect to the checks and balances on the part of the legislature against the judiciary, you absolutely have the check exercised quite often that if there is a decision from an appellate court or a trial court, for that matter, that you disagree with, that you think wrongly interpreted a statute, you can change the statute. It happens. The legislature can, quote, overrule, which is what it's doing, a court decision or change how it would come out in the future by adjusting the statute, clarifying the language, saying what you want it to mean in a different way. And at least once every legislature, there is a case with, or there is a bill with introductory language. Because of this and such case, we are adopting the following. I believe that your Ledge Affairs Agency goes through all the court's opinions and chooses those that you may have to address.
Allow me to interrupt that through the chair, because that is not overruling. That is actually submitting to the decision of the court and accepting their decision and then going back and changing the statute. So that's not actually overruling it.
Through the chair to Senator Hughes, I have seen wording in those bills that say, in an attempt to overrule this court decision, you can't change it for past the parties to that litigation, but you can put in this, if the court says the statute means X, you can say, we didn't want that. We didn't want the court to say that. We will change our statute so that it more clearly says Y. And that is a way that you can tell the court and change things that let the court know what you meant to be thinking about that. You do have the power of the purse, which you acknowledge. You can make constitutional, take the first step towards making a constitutional step, which you acknowledge. All the court has is the ability to be reactive. So to the extent people are saying the court is involved in these election cases or taking political positions, the court isn't seeking these cases. If people could resolve them themselves, we would be that much happier. But when an election case comes up with one political party against, or a branch against a branch, or a political view against a political view, the court does and must resolve that one way or the other. I think people see those decisions and draw conclusions about the judge who made that decision. But if the decision came out the other way, it is likely that the other side would draw a different conclusion about that person. I mean, all I can say is the judge decides based on exactly what's in front of them. And the only thing the court can do that, that nobody can do, because somebody in a constitutional form of government has to do it, is decide if something is violating the Constitution. That's for the benefit of the people. And I heard Madam Chair say this morning on the floor that we need somehow someone to say if an action is unconstitutional, a governmental action is unconstitutional. It is the court who's charged with doing that.
Follow-up?
Please, Senator Hugh.
Yeah, thank you. I still abide by my comment that it, when the legislature has to take further action to clarify, it is still accepting what the court has said and therefore the need to do it. They actually aren't striking it out and providing the same kind of balance that we see in other ways. The politics. So back when our state constitution was written, the politics of attorneys overall was pretty fairly balanced. And that has changed. And there are surveys and studies and research to that effect. So we do know that more than not, attorneys lean to the left. So now we have politics, whether we like it or not, no matter how we go about this, just based on numbers. And I have had attorneys who are members of the Bar Association who've made it very clear to me that unless you have left of center leanings, your ability to move your way and get an appointment is very, very difficult. And I just wanted to put that on the record. I've had attorneys approach me and agree with bringing the people's branch into this process, at least for these lower courts. So I just wanted to say that, Madam Chair.
And to the chair, may I respond just briefly?
Briefly. I want to first acknowledge that Senator Schauer has been on. The list was so long that I missed it, so I apologize. Senator Schauer is online with us. Please proceed, Nancy, and then I'd like the opportunity to ask a question. And we may be able to each ask one more small question, but we've got quite a few people online. So
I'll be fast then, Chair Reinbold. I will just say that if a conservative lawyer believes that he or she cannot be appointed because of their politics, I would have to point out that that can't be true, because we have plenty of judges who come from backgrounds that one might view as quite conservative who made it through the council and who are appointed judges. So perhaps, I don't know if there's something else in that's discouraging that person from applying, but it's just not borne out by the facts.
Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and ask a question because I'm in line here too. I had the exact same question, the checks on the judicial branch, about a half a dozen times just since my purview down here. Laws have been struck down by the courts, by one person, just striking it down. And I'm going to use one example that has just shooken me to the core of my being, is Chief Justice Fabe. It was not even about abortion. It was about parental rights. And we worked so hard on the issue. And way back, I believe it was 2006, I went before her hearing. She had public testimony. And I believe it was 19 or 20 out of 20 people that wanted the parents involved in a decision to allow their daughter an abortion. And she struck it down the next day, the parental rights. And I tell you, nothing has shooken me more in the courts than that. For the parents' rights to be involved in the decision, I mean, if that to me was just an outrageous move on the court's part, and then I could the bill Senator Hughes and I worked on together got struck down. The election integrity, I could go on and on. Where is the balance? You guys, it takes so much energy to come down to Juneau. It's hard to have a capital in Juneau and have to meet here in a very short period of time, and then to get 60 people with all different priorities to be able to change legislation is an extremely heavy lift. But a judge just in the back room, you know, in a courtroom, can just strike down a law. It's so simple, just kind of like what the governor does. So you have not answered the question, where is the check on the judiciary that is so important for peace?
To the chair, I don't think there's probably much I could say right now that would keep you satisfied in terms of the specific case that you mentioned. I will say that somebody, some entity in government, has to protect the people and uphold the Constitution when there is something that is the government does that's unconstitutional. Somebody has to make the decision. It's the court that makes that decision. And if the court makes the decision not based on popularity, not based on what the majority of the people want, but what the Constitution provides, and that's considered a protection for people. I mean, it is a built-in protection so that unconstitutional laws don't take effect.
So with that, you said you were to protect the people and uphold the Constitution. Explain to me how that protects people, the decision that was made, when it's the ability of a random person, like a school person, to take a girl to go get an abortion without their parents' consent. I mean, I am sorry, but that, there's, the Constitution says, with the Declaration of Independence, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The right to life is the very first thing that completely contradicts the Constitution. So I'm bewildered by your answer.
Well, to the chair, there are lots of rights in the Constitution, such as due process and such as privacy and such as equal protection, that all come into play. I'm afraid I'm not prepared to defend the Supreme Court's decision in any one particular case. I'd be happy to talk about it with you another time. But I am aware that the Supreme Court ensures that the Constitution is followed for the benefit of everybody in this state who understands that the Constitution is the supreme law of the state.
And through that, do you think the unborn child has rights to life?
Through the chair, again, I can't speak to a specific case.
This isn't a specific case. I'm just simply asking, do you believe the unborn child has the right to life?
To the chair, I'm not prepared to answer that question here in this forum.
Okay, Senator Keel, if you could ask one more question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I very much appreciated, Madam Chair, the testifier you invited the other day who spoke about how wisely Justice Douglas wrote the majority decision in Griswold v. Connecticut that acknowledged, as he said, that our rights emanate from the penumbra of the rights enumerated in the Bill of Rights, and that those protect the rights of the people. Thank you for inviting him, because I think that really gives us a good view, the testifier you invited, as to how the courts truly do protect the people. My question for Ms. Mead, you have articulated here a view of the separation of powers and checks and balances that I think, if I'm correct, emanates in the U.S. Supreme Court's from the U.S. Supreme Court's Marbury versus Madison decision. My question to you, Ms. Mead, were the framers of Alaska's Constitution aware of the Marbury v. Madison decision, and did they alter it in writing our Constitution?
Through the chair to Senator Keel, I can't speak to their mindset, but it was an 1803 decision that provided for judicial review, and those who wrote the judiciary article were almost undoubtedly aware of the Supreme Court decisions and the United States constitutional provisions that set forth what all those laws were at the time that they sat in 1959.
The second part, did they alter that framework of judicial review and the separation of powers?
Through the chair to Senator Keel, no, they didn't.
Thank you.
Okay. Senator Hughes?
Yes, and we could have a longer conversation, but I'm going to keep it. There was mention of a litmus test, and then you've mentioned the importance of The judge's duty is strict adherence to the Constitution, maybe some confusion of what strict adherence to the statutes might involve, but I am aware that judges will refer to the intent of the legislature, the debate that happens in the legislature in regard to a statute. So one of the things is this last March, we had a debate on the Senate floor and chose not to remove the requirement of signatures being witnessed on absentee ballots in lieu of the pandemic underway. And about 6 months later, a judge struck that down, and supposedly on a constitutional basis that we all have the right to vote. But yet in the Constitution, it says specifically that the methods, I don't have the exact language in front of me, the methods for absentee voting will be determined by law. We are the lawmakers. We debated that law, and we decided to leave that signature witness requirement in place. And when I see a judge making that decision, I see that as a unilateral lawmaking. Do you have any comments about that?
Through the chair to Senator Hughes, I'm aware of the decision that you're speaking of, which, by the way, was affirmed unanimously by the Supreme Court shortly thereafter. That case is still pending. I will say that I have the decision. It's 15 pages of well-reasoned, thorough analysis. It discusses that right to vote, and it weighs it against the burden on the weight that is put in place just during the pandemic, just this once, by having two signatures. It doesn't suspend the statute henceforth, but during the pandemic, because of circumstances, those two signatures are an unconstitutional burden on the right to vote. Now, with respect to legislative intent, I actually am not aware that any of the attorneys argued anything about legislative intent. That conversation took place on the floor. It's actually very difficult to research and find what happens when there are amendments on the floor. But even so, the ruling was based on the Constitution, and even if the legislature wanted something in place, if it offends the Constitution, what you intend is still not as prime in our hierarchy of law as what the Constitution requires. And again, I'd be happy to talk about that case off record a little bit more if anybody is interested.
And as a quick follow-up, Madam Chair,
okay,
very quick.
Just a comment.
There are recordings, a KTOO, of Senate floor debate, so I don't think that is that difficult to find. And in the 15-page decision, was the part of the Constitution that applied to the fact that absentee voting methods should be determined by law, was that mentioned in those 15 pages? And was the March vote of the Senate of the legislature mentioned in that 15-page decision?
Through the chair to Senator Hughes, I would have to review the decision. I'm sorry.
If you could follow up with us, Madam Chair.
And I'd be happy to provide a copy.
Thank you. And I'm going to provide leeway today. Senator Kill, if you could be very, very quick, because we are like way behind now.
Madam Chair, I'll pose a question for written follow-up, if I may.
That'd be fine.
Madam Chair, the question to the court system has to do with the magistrate portions of the bill, shifting off ideology. I am interested in how you see the bill applying to currently seated magistrates, or whether you think it applies only to new vacancies. I am interested in what happens with the court system's ability to fire a magistrate, which I believe they have today and would lose under the bill, both practically and same question, how it rolls forward over time. And then I'm interested in the court system's take on the discipline of magistrates, which I believe now is an administrative function and would change here. I need to understand the implications. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And you can get back to us on
that. I appreciate the questions. I would have testified, but I'll provide it in writing.
Okay, and I'm going to ask my final question to you. And I know this is this is just something I think I already know the answer, but I want it on record. I'm still trying to find checks and balances on the judicial branch, which I am having a very hard time finding. But many do believe that there is tremendous political activism in the court. And I will be having a hearing in regards to that. And some believe that they're echo chambers as well, unanimous decisions, et cetera. So there's not a lot of diversity of thought often. But what my question to you is In regards to the case that Senator Hughes brought up, now the governor has proposed bills on election integrity, et cetera. It's a very, very big theme in the legislature right now. What is the court's position on bringing a judge such as Judge Crosby just to be able to ask questions before the Judiciary Committee?
To the chair, I'm afraid that's not going to happen. I can, again, explain her decision to you. Her decision speaks for itself. It's very thorough. It provides all the reasoning that it's an official record. The only things that are part of the record are things that are filed in court and things that are put in writing, and extraneous comments or justifications or explanations for decisions are not something that the court will engage in.
So therefore, we can't even have someone come before our judicial committee that oversees activities in regards to the courts, come before the legislative branch. So there's like virtually little to no checks and balances on the courts. And I think that's one of the the big concerns is the oversight of the courts. There has to be checks and balances where the people's branch, the legislative branch, should be the most powerful. If you read the Founding Father documents, and it seems to be one of the weaker ones. But with that, I know we took over a half an hour. We took almost 40 minutes with you. So, Nancy, thank you for coming before us today, okay? And I'll look forward to more conversations with you. I definitely want another meeting with you in my office in regards to some of your concerns. And I'd like to meet with Senator Showers in regards to that as well. But anyway, thank you.
Can I ask you a question?
Oh, I'm sorry. I am so sorry. I meant to get to you. Senator Shower, can you go ahead and ask one question? And we will bring Nancy back if we need to.
One.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you. I'm sorry. I've been listening to conversations. So I'm not surprised that the courts are circling the wagons because this is what happened the last 2 years. We tried this in previous. I would expect it, and that's okay. And I think there's quite a bit of disagreement when you look at what the judge did on that particular thing. The legislature's intent was quite clear, and I know the answer always becomes legal speak, and oh, well, it was in the Constitution, but I can tell you right now a lot of people think that was an unconstitutional decision because it's our purview, not yours. So my question is this, because I continue to find it fascinating and also somewhat offensive, that it's always politics. The answer has been for years now from the courts and the representative of the courts that we're not political and we can separate ourselves from politics and we're unbiased and we're objective. And somehow they can do that in all of their decisions, even though two-thirds of the ABA are Democrats and one-third Republicans, whatever. That's not the point. My point is that people have their biases and their things. And the court continues to tell us that they're good, they're not political, and they're able to stay above the fray. And they can make it happen without any political injection into their decisions, their personal biases, et cetera. And yet somehow, if the legislature was to have one small say in the process for an up-and-down vote, for example, on potential nominees, there is no way that we cannot inject politics into it. We are not smart enough. We are not of the moral character that we could possibly make good decisions based on the merits of those candidates as anything other than political monsters. And I quite honestly find that position of the courts quite offensive as a person that can think and can intelligently look at somebody's merit and their backgrounds and make a valid decision without injecting politics into it. My question for the courts is, and this should be an interesting answer because I understand this might be fascinating for Nancy to say this, how can the courts, as human beings, make these unbiased decisions, but 60 legislators can't somehow make a wise decision over nominees without it being a political circus? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Nancy.
Through the chair to Senator Shower. I understand that there's a bit of a disconnect between Senator Shower and myself and maybe others on this point. Judges are, by training and experience and constant adherence to the ethical code, taught and trained, and all their experience is about applying the law to the facts in a particular case without taking account other matters. In fact, through the appointment process, the Judicial Council tries to ensure that people who are nominated will not let anything personal play into their future decision making. The legislature, during legislative confirmations, and it is not a slight, it's not meant to be offensive whatsoever, certainly looks at the political affiliation of somebody, whether it's for the Board of Fish or whether it's for a cabinet position or whether it's for any of the many boards and commissions that you look at. The things that are viewed are, I mean, some of those votes, many of those votes are along caucus or party lines. And that is just not an indication that you don't care about merit. It's an indication that what happens in this building is political. It's allowed to be political. It's more or less designed to be political. You're supposed to represent the politics and the views of your constituents. The politics and views of your constituents are tied to partisan issues, political issues, and again, not in any negative way. It's just that it's a different type of structure here, and it's something that I think, having seen now my 11th year of confirmations and appointments, does necessarily involve political considerations.
Okay, so with that, Nancy, we may invite you back to talk about the ethical code of judges. And, you know, print that out and have that open discussion since you've brought it up multiple times. I think that might be a great opportunity here to learn more about how you guys judge them based on ethical standards. And I just did want to say that we have to be out in the open. We're on cameras. There's cameras all over this building. There's cameras on us right now. We are vetted thoroughly and sometimes viciously during the election and campaign process. And so a lot of people do know where we stand on many, many issues because it's such a difficult process that we go through. And I think just putting a stamp of approval, up or down vote with Senator Schauer, you know what he says in regard to legislation, may provide a little bit more checks and balances. But in regards to what Senator Hughes talked about, we can't rule out that there is a potential for political vetting somewhere behind the scenes, because I can tell you I've had lawyers complain to me. I have had Department of Law people, multiple of them, complain about they are afraid to speak their mind at Department of Law. And some of them have left because it's such a hostile environment for conservatives. So we can't just be so naive that to just deny that it happens. I can tell you people that happens in my district. And so I'm not going to just wash it under the carpet just because someone says that it doesn't exist. It does exist. And so I just think that it's important to address an issue that does happen in this state, and we will be having a hearing in regards to political activism in the court. It's something we just can't sweep under the carpet just because they want to believe that. I think it needs to be discussed and talked about because many people believe that there is activism in the court. But this bill right now is before us, and it still needs some work, and I still think that your opinion is important. And we possibly will bring you back. If not, we want to keep the door open to talk to you. Even amendments are coming up on Monday or Wednesday next week. I'm not sure what they're going to look like yet. But anyway, Nancy, we want to continue the discussion. We want to thank you for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
So I am going to I'm going to just ask people to be patient online, okay? I am going to go to the next invited. We have three more invited testimonies, and I'm really going to ask you guys to keep it to 5 minutes. Typically, I do invited testimony. That was about 45 minutes that we discussed several different issues, and we appreciate the questions being answered. Suzanne DiPietro, if you could just state your name for the record, and you've got 5 minutes, okay? And thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Chair Reinbold and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. My name is Suzanne DiPietro, and I'm the Director of the Alaska Judicial Council. Thank you for the opportunity to provide information about the Judicial Council as you deliberate on this very significant legislation. So, as Ms. Mead mentioned, SB 14 would make fundamental changes to both how judges are selected and how they are evaluated for retention. I'll just briefly discuss both of those changes. First of all, the changes to the appointment of judges and magistrates. So the merit selection and retention process in Alaska's Constitution for Supreme and Superior Court judges, which were the only two courts that were adopted in the Constitution, was adopted as the best means to ensure a nonpartisan and professional judiciary. And in fact, one of the drafters of the judiciary article said, "We are trying to avoid the travesties which we have witnessed in some of the states where judges are picked and plucked directly from the ward political office." The Judicial Council was created to play a key role in the selection of those judges by nominating only the most qualified for appointment by the governor. Senate Bill 14, as Ms. Mead mentioned, would create a different selection procedure, gubernatorial appointment with legislative confirmation, for courts that did not exist when the Constitution was adopted. In other words, the Court of Appeals, the District Court, and the magistrate judges. In deciding whether to change the judicial selection process, it may be useful to know a bit more about how the council members nominate the most qualified applicants. The council's procedures are transparent, thorough, and focused on merit. First, transparency. The council's procedures are posted on its website and provided to all applicants. The council also publishes the criteria it uses for nomination. On thoroughness, the council members review extensive and detailed information about each applicant's work experience, life experience, skills, ethics, and commitment to public service. The council members conduct a public hearing and they interview each and every applicant. The evaluation process takes about 6 months. On merit, the council members evaluate each applicant against merit-based criteria, including professional competence, diligence and administrative skills, integrity, fairness, temperament, common sense, legal and life experience, and demonstrated commitment to public service, equal justice, and the legal needs of the diverse communities of Alaska. The council members are specifically and explicitly not allowed to consider an applicant's political or religious affiliation. Another hallmark of the council's process is collegiality. Members deliberate independently and as a group, and each member is given equal time to share his or her thoughts about each applicant. So given the rigor of the council's process, it is not surprising that at the end of the day, the council members most often agree as a group about which applicants are most qualified. In fact, many people are surprised to know that about 83% of all the council's votes are unanimous or unanimous but for one. Another fact is how rarely the Chief Justice votes. Only about 5% of all votes historically are votes in which the Chief Justice participates. And it is even rarer for a Chief Justice to break a tie between the attorneys and the non-attorneys. That has happened in only 1% of all votes, or only 19 times in over 35 years. This is not surprising when you consider the thoroughness of the process that the council uses and the collegiality of their work. So I wanted to mention real quickly, Senate Bill 14 also would add nomination of magistrates to the council's duties. So this would require the council to screen, interview, and nominate additional applicants for magistrate positions each year, and likely would require more targeted outreach to attract both attorneys and non-attorneys to apply for magistrate positions. As Ms. Mead mentioned, those can be difficult to fill. Next, I'd like to briefly touch on changes to the evaluation of judges standing for retention. Again, Senate Bill 14 would transfer this duty to evaluate judges standing for retention from the council to an agency called the Alaska Commission on Judicial Conduct. Just give you a little bit of background about the current retention evaluation system and its outcomes. So the council has been evaluating judges since 1975. The council's approach relies in significant part on reviews from court users. This includes law enforcement officers, probation officers, jurors, court employees, members of the public, and social services professionals. Then the council also investigates judges' published opinions, any ethical problems, disqualifications from cases, compliance with financial and other disclosure laws, professional activities, and even whether a judge's paycheck has been withheld for untimely decisions. This information, along with the council's recommendation on retention, is provided directly to the public via the council's website and summarized in the Lieutenant Governor's official election pamphlet. So how has this system been working out? Well, during the past several decades, court users have given increasingly positive reviews of judges' performances. This is seen in the surveys of attorneys and law enforcement and probation officers, which have been rising over the past 20 to 30 years. However, in rare instances, it is true that court users have reported significant problems with a judge, or the council's investigation has revealed negative performance or ethics issues. In those instances, the council publicized the negative information to the public, and when warranted, it has recommended against the retention of a judge. If Senate Bill 14 were adopted, this retention evaluation data, all this extensive data collected by the council, would instead be collected by the commission. And this would mean that the council members would no longer have access to the detailed feedback about the performance of the judges they nominated. So this could inadvertently deprive council members of an important source of information about which characteristics of applicants translate into exceptional performance on the bench. So the council monitors very closely the connection between the its nominees who are appointed and their performance later on the bench to ensure that its process continues to be strongly based in merit and nonpartisan. And then I just wanted to share one final thing about the members of the Judicial Council. They come from all walks of life, and they bring many different perspectives and experiences to their work. Despite these apparent differences, the principle that unites them all is an unwavering focus on promoting a fair, impartial, and professional bench in Alaska. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Susan. We do appreciate your time, and I have seen some diversity on the Judicial Council. So, you know, in fairness, I definitely have seen that. And I'm going to allow Senator Schauer, since we're running a little behind right now, if he has any questions.
Thank you, Senator Rambold. I do have, it's more of a comment, but the Speaker may wish to address it. As I said with the courts and Mrs. Mead, the representative, it's not surprising they're circling the wagon. This is a don't touch our empire. I get it. I understand that. But my question would be, nobody has addressed it, and they continue to avoid the question, is how do they justify that basically a trade organization, and she admitted the facts there, 19 times in 35 years. That doesn't sound like much, but 19 times there was zero input from the people. Nobody's representative chose judges that sit on the bench and decide what happens to people and their lives through judicial decisions. How do they justify that a trade association, in essence, has the ultimate ability and authority to pick who sits on and controls one-third of our government? As I have said before, people would lose their minds if the legislature got together to pick who the next legislators are. But that is, in essence, how our court system is set up when the ABA, a guild, is allowed to pick who our judges are. And they'll try to tell you with good numbers and talk smooth, but it hardly ever happens. Our point has been from the beginning, it does, and it has. How do you justify that you can have a guild with no cross-check, no voice of the people, a private organization, fills most of those slots and has ultimate control? How do you justify that position controlling a third of the government structure?
Well, through the chair, Senator Schauer, you know, the structure was set up by the constitutional founders, and they talked about this quite a bit, who would be on the Judicial Council. And they really sort of had two thoughts. First of all, they wanted to have at least three of the members to be attorneys, and the idea there was that as attorneys, they would know, I think the language was, who is good and who is not. Because the attorneys are going to have to practice underneath these judges, and the attorneys are going to be invested, I mean, for the sake of the state and also for the sake of the practice of law, invested in really good judges who are going to give them a fair shake no matter who their client is, because attorneys have all kinds of different clients. And so that was the reasoning at the Constitutional Convention. I certainly don't see how it's not still true today. The other thing about the Bar Association, of course, this is just for the record, of course you are well aware, the committee is well aware, that the Bar Association is created by statute and it comes up for sunset every so often. I'm not an expert on that, but certainly the legislature is involved with the Bar Association. And I just wanted to sort of clarify on those 19 votes that the Chief Justice made, that was 19 out of over 1,400 votes over a 35-year period. So it is true that it happens, but I really would like to just reemphasize that it is, like, shockingly rare.
Okay, Susan?
I love an answer, Madam Chair, but thank you.
Okay, thank you. We are going to move to the next Speaker, just a second. I got questions too. Jesse, can you make it real quick?
Sure, Madam Chair. I could again ask questions to follow up in writing if you'd like.
It's fine if you prefer that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In that case, a research question for Ms. DiPietro. In the case of those 19 of more than 1,000, how many times was the person selected for forwarding by only the attorneys and the Chief Justice, the governor's only choice? And since I suspect I know the answer, despite the use of the phrase ultimate control, in how many of those cases of the 19 were all the choices forwarded to the governor selected by only the three attorneys and the Chief Justice? That's question one for the historical research. And then an important question on the impact of the bill. I'd like to know the comparative workload to screen a judge or magistrate for a selection versus to screen a judge or magistrate for a retention vote, and how that affects the total workload of the commission. I'm interested particularly in the budgetary considerations. And Madam Chair, I'm happy to take that that response in writing.
Thank you, Senator Keel. So I'm going to just ask three questions together in one, but first I'm going to make a quick statement that it's easier to be collegial, you know, when you don't have to go through combat with campaigns and all the stuff that goes on, the policies. We have to vet them with 60 different people and the governor, and we're held so tightly responsible with the people that brought us here. But my biggest question is still is, where are the checks and balances with the judicial branch? That answer is still missing, and I really would we need that answered. And it's easy to be collegial when you are able to choose your next member, and if you believe similar, and you're chosen by friends and people that you've worked with, and then you have the ability for the backup vote from the Chief Justice. I just think it's an environment that works in many, many cases, but it all actually has its challenges as well. So with that, one, I'm going to ask you if you can bring the ethical conduct. I'm not sure if it would be Nancy or you that could bring that. Second, I want you to answer if the meetings for judicial review and judges selection are completely open to the public. And the third question I'm going to ask you, if you could give us the surveys from the past 5 years or something similar, if maybe that's too much, I'm willing to scroll it down. But it would be really good to hear. I know one of my amendments years ago was to ensure that surveys went out to people that came before judges. And as far as I know, you guys are following that. And maybe it was even in place before that. And we just wanted to make sure it continued. But if you could just answer that really quickly. And then I'm not going to take any more questions from you, Susan, because I think I have seven more people online. So can you just answer those real quickly?
I think I can, Senator Chair Reinbold. I think the first question was about the Code of Ethical Conduct, and actually I could talk about it, but actually Ms. Greenstein with the Commission on Judicial Conduct would probably be a better person, especially since we're so short on time. You asked about which portions of the meetings are open. And so on the selection of judges, when the council goes to the community to interview people who want to be a judge, the council has a public hearing, which is open. The council has administrative agenda, which is open to the public. And any applicant can have his or her hearing in public. And just about every meeting, at least one applicant does choose to have a public interview. On the retention of judges, there is a statewide teleconference public hearing that the legislature has been kind enough to loan the statewide LIO teleconference system to the Judicial Council for, and that is a critical part of the evaluation of judges. I think that was that question. You asked about surveys for the past 5 years, and I'm sorry I didn't understand that question.
Okay, so Susan, basically you reworded my question. What I ask is, are all judicial hearings completely open to the public? That's what I'd like a yes or a no answer to.
To the chair, all judicial hearings, meaning all the council's interviews, or
everything in regards to the appointment of a judge, is it completely open and public and transparent?
To the chair, significant portions of the process are open to the public and posted on our website. All the applications of the applicants are posted on the website. The results of the bar survey are posted on the website. The agenda for the meeting, many materials, press releases. So
That's not my question. My question is, are all aspects of hearing of judges and appointees completely and fully open to the public? I'm trying to figure out, is that a yes or a no?
To the chair, the deliberations of the council are not open to the public.
Okay. Okay, thank you. And the last question, and I'll just talk to Nancy about this later, but just some sort of review of the different surveys of the people and their belief system in regards to the satisfaction with the court. And I think you guys have spoken to both of those, but that would be really a really interesting conversation to have as well. So with that, we have got to move on. I'm going to, and thank you, Susan, for being with us today. We appreciate it. So that's been over an hour now with the courts and with the Judicial Council. So I apologize, Wes Keller, former Representative Wes Keller. I believe you were Judiciary Chair as well. If you could stick to 5 minutes and we're probably going to have no questions, that would be great. And then we'll have Scott Ogan after that for 5 minutes, and then we're going to get on to these people waiting online.
Thank you, Chair. Reinbold, I will first want to say I'm Wes Keller. I'm not lobbying for anybody. I'm speaking for myself, and I thank you for this opportunity to have some input. thanks to all of you for your service in the legislature. From a distance, it sure looks like your job is getting tougher every year. And I thank you for hanging in there. I appreciate it. It's a good reminder what committee meetings are like. You know, my mind is racing, and there's a lot of different directions I'd like to go, but I'm going to stick to a real short presentation and then leave it open for questions. The only way that the rule of law has any authority, for our government will even work, is if the judiciary is properly working with the other two branches, and the legislature in particular. I think that's obvious. When you look at the Constitution and the values of the Constitution. And it also has to reflect the values of the voters. And you just can't have legislators and the judiciary working together and reflecting the needs and the interests of the people without some level of politics in the process. And if you draw that line too tight, I think there's an isolation problem. Where the judiciary ends up not representing the people. In my opinion, the legislature has not used the muscle that was clearly given in the Constitution to refine the judiciary and make it responsive to the people. HB 14 moves the needle a little bit, and I appreciate it very much. Senator Schauer, thank you for bringing this forward. I cannot help but make a real quick comment that you not surprised by the circling of the wagons. And I got to tell you, I was between time of the staff and legislator down there in 20 years. I have seen the circle happen many times on this issue. And I got to tell you that I fear, I've worried that you're outgunned here. I mean, the same thing. Some of the very fine people in the judiciary have testified even today. I consider friends, but I've heard it all before, and I think there's still a problem, and I just would ask them to pay attention to it. We cannot have justice without a good standard, without a good law. It has to be based on, rule of law, in order for it to work, it has to be a good law, a good standard. And the legislature, of course, is the at least the nominal last word in what that standard is. And it's, again, intended to reflect the value of the voters. I'm just going to read real quickly from the Alaska's Constitution, the Citizen's Guide, the 5th edition, dated January 20, this year, 2021. Just a comment on page, I think it's 93, where Article 4 where it defines the judiciary. And I'm just going to, I'll tell you one, begin quote here. It's flexible because the judiciary is flexible because it specifies only the rudimentary structure of the court system and gives the legislature wide latitude to expand and shape the system to meet the needs of the state. The delegates anticipated the future by authorizing the legislature to expand the court system by adding judges and creating new courts. Like I say, HB 14 is, I think, a small step. I think it's a very important one. In fact, I think it's far more important than what you may realize. I know it's intimidating to be to be there, and I just would ask that you stand up here. I'll just stop there and ask, you know, if you have questions, that'd be great. If you know, if you want me to expand on something I said, I don't mind. But thank you again.
Former Representative Wes Keller, thank you for being with us today. Unfortunately, we do not have time for questions. However, the committee is obviously able to email you if necessary. With that, thank you for being with us. Scott Ogan is up next. State your name, please, affiliation, and you've got 5 minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll do my best to be brief. My name is Scott Ogan. I'm the Senior Policy Advisor for Senator Mike Schauer. I served in this building 10 years, both in the House and the Senate. You know, the court system talked about this bill undermines the independence of the judiciary. And some might argue that the judiciary is a little bit too independent because they're almost untouchable and with very little accountability. The whole system of evaluating judges is done by the same people that nominate them. Could there possibly be a little bit of sense of ownership there that they don't, you know, if you nominate the judge, are they going to be as critical as maybe the person that evaluates the judges? And that would be the Commission on Judicial Conduct. They get the complaints. They understand what the people's issues are. They adjudicate those complaints, and they can make recommendations to the Supreme Court on whether or not a judge should be actually removed. That branch or that commission is actually six lawyers. Three of them are appointed by the Chief Justice. Three of them are also are subject to confirmation. They're lawyers, but they're subject to confirmation by the legislature. And then there's three members of the public. And so I think it's a more appropriate approach to have the folks that are taking the complaints actually write the evaluations that the public can look at. The courts complained that the judiciary would be like a GC the DC model. They implied by their testimony that it was like the whole judiciary is going to be suddenly subject to the legislature's whim. It's a very small slice of it, Madam Chair. It's the appellate court. Right now, the appellate courts only have authority in criminal matters, not civil matters. And it's also the magistrates. You know, all power comes from the people. That's what our Constitution says. All power is derived from the people, except for the one carve out is the Judicial Council and the Bar Association. There's such tight sideboards on those on how judges are appointed, with only two names being able to be considered by the governor, and he can't veto it. He can't reject it. He's got to take one of the two, and so. The litmus test. Basically says to follow the Constitution and the statutes and the regs and strictly interpret those. I would hope every judge would do that. Why is that a problem? Who's the best qualified? I already went over that point. I want to say one other thing, then I'm going to wrap it up. I've talked to several conservative lawyers and asked them to testify, and nobody wants to do it. And if the judiciary was so impartial and able to separate themselves from their personal feelings or their biases in every single case, why would those that present before them and have cases before them not want to speak up? I'll leave it there if anybody has any questions.
Thank you. Scott Ogan. Mr. Ogan, thank you very much for being with us today. Your boss is actually asked to make a comment at the end. So we actually have a minute left. There's time, Senator Keel, if you want to ask one question. And
thank you, Madam Chair. I can ask questions of the sponsor staff offline. I'm hoping that we'll have the opportunity to hear from the Commission on Judicial Conduct because the bill is a major impact on their review or their work in the judicial branch.
Yes, they're online.
Great, thank
so
you.
That's why we're tightening everything up. So with that, thank you, Mr. Ogan.
Thank you.
Next, we were going to have Sandin Fisher. I'm not sure if you wanted to speak or not, if you're just online for observation.
Senator Reinbold, this is, for the record, Sandin Fisher from Legal Services. I'm simply here for legal questions, if I can help with anything.
Okay, excellent. And I apologize for not recognizing you. I made an assumption that you were going to testify. So with that, thank you, Sandin, for being online. Next, we are going to go to Marla Greinstein. I'm sorry if I've said your name wrong, but if you could please state your name for the record. I know you're the executive director on the Commission of Judicial Conduct. And if you could just state your name and proceed, that would be great. We're going to try to give you a total of 5 minutes just out of courtesy, including question and answers. So please proceed.
Thank you very much, Chair Reinbold. Yes, for the record, my name is Marla Greenstein, and you're correct. I'm the Executive Director of the Commission on Judicial Conduct, and it's a position I've held since 1989. So I've had over 30 years in this position, and during the course of those 30 years, I can tell you that I've worked closely with the court system and the Judicial Council, and we've adapted and adopted procedures so that our work can complement each other efficiently and effectively. It's kind of like pieces in a jigsaw puzzle that we've kind of shaped our pieces as the needs have arisen and streamlined our functions, and that, as I'm sure you can appreciate, the major changes proposed by SB 14 will require substantial reshaping, if you will, of how we conduct our business. So our agency is the one that is charged with enforcing the Code of Judicial Conduct, which is the Code of Ethics for the Judiciary. It's a very narrow job that we have. Our nine-member commission is, as Mr. Ogan recognized, is three judges, three lawyers, and three public members. And from an ethics viewpoint, they each bring something very unique and important in analyzing any ethical issues that come before us as a commission to evaluate. Each of our commission meetings is held four times a year. We're a very streamlined, small office. As Senator Keel knew from when he was a staffer, we have the tiniest little two-person staff that is able to function. And back in his day, he always had questions about why we were always adjusting our increments. And it's because we're such a small agency staff-wise that we really have to kind of switch things around pretty carefully to keep up to make sure we're fully funded from the personnel point of view. We also have a separate line item that allows us to hire outside counsel should we go to disciplinary hearings, because we are an adjudicative body in that we, like other hearing officers, we handle a complaint, we investigate that complaint, and then the commission, the nine-member commission, sits as a hearing body to adjudicate that complaint. When we go through that process, my role changes and outside counsel is hired to present that matter to the judges. Another big function that we provide is that I am kind of on call for judges all the time to give ethics advice. So whenever a judge has an ethical question, they know they can call me or write me an email, and I'll get back to them right away. A lot of times they need these answers pretty quickly if they have to determine whether they have a conflict in a case coming up in front of them, if they're asked to speak before a group and they want to make sure it's an appropriate group for them to speak to. So this function is really important, and I'm very proud of the relationship that we have, that the commission has the trust of the judges. That they know they can candidly call me if they have a problem. If a family member, for example, has a criminal case, can they still sit on criminal cases? They can be honest and forthright with their very confidential inquiries about ethical dilemmas that they have. One of the fears that we have is taking on the retention function is that trust and confidence, that informal ability to be open and honest with us and preventing ethical lapses and really guiding the judiciary could be put in jeopardy if we would also then have all that responsibility to evaluate them as to whether they can continue on in their job for as a retention evaluation. And in this respect, I just wanted to comment that Mr. Ogun mentioned that we already do evaluation. And I just have to say that while it certainly may appear that way, and in fact, the original constitutional name of our commission was the Judicial Qualifications Commission, that name was changed because it didn't accurately reflect the work that we do. We are the Judicial Conduct Commission. We do ethics enforcement and ethical guidance. And a judicial evaluation, in other words, a job evaluation, is a very separate and a very different type of process. As a result, I mean, it's a lot of work to do with judicial retention evaluations, as Mr. DiPietro outlined for you, and it would require our nice little two-person office to expand. We would, I estimate, need require two additional staff people, which requires additional office space, assuming we're back in our offices, and at least one additional commission meeting each year. In addition, the legislature, when they set up our commission, obviously thought it was important to separate the functions of judicial retention and judicial ethics, in that there's a provision in our governing statute that says no member of the commission can simultaneously sit on both the conduct commission and the judicial council. So there was some awareness of the separate functions and the need for those to be separate. I have a lot more I can say, but I really do want to be able to answer your questions if I can.
Thank you, Marla. I've actually never had the opportunity to meet you, and I did give you a couple extra minutes on top of the 5 minutes, but I thought your opinion is very important. And I'm only going to allow Senator Schauer at this time, if he has a question, to ask you directly. Senator, do you have a question or no?
One quick one. Thank you, Senator Reynolds. My comment will be later. Is does she believe that it's kind of what I heard a little bit was it's more about resources necessary than perhaps the principle of SB 14? And my question would be if that is at least partially the case, because I heard the concern over resources being able to do the job, would it be something more acceptable if that review process went appointing the magistrates and the appellates went to the Judicial Council as they do now for the Superior Court and the Supreme Court? Thank you.
Did you hear that clearly, Marla?
Senator Schauer, through the chair, I'm a little confused because the resources I was talking to is about the retention evaluation. If you're asking me about the increased resources for the magistrate selection, I'm not sure. If you're asking me about, from my perspective, adding the ethical responsibilities for magistrates, that's what I can speak to directly. The ethical responsibility for magistrates in and of itself, I imagine, would not necessarily require a full-time. I developed the cost based on the retention. If all we had were the ethical responsibility for magistrates, that would probably require just one additional part-time person because it would almost double the amount of judges whose ethics we would oversee and could result in more frequent disciplinary hearings.
I'll follow up offline, Senator Rumble. Thank you. That's probably too much for the time you have. Thanks.
Thank you, and feel free to write it up before the whole committee. We may all want the answer in regards to that. But, Marla, because we're running short of time, I've got to be out of this room in about less than 10 minutes. I'm just going to quickly ask you, I believe it was Nancy Mead that asked me to get the ethical code of conduct for judges and magistrates from you. One, can you provide that to my email? I think you can find my email easily. And second, I'm going to ask, I have never had the opportunity to meet you, so it was great to have you on today. And if you could potentially invite all of the Judiciary Committee potentially to a hearing that we can all become more informed and educated about the process, I think that would be an excellent place to have potentially a field trip for the Judiciary Committee. So with that, are you interested in that?
Chair Reynolds, yes, absolutely. And right now, we do always have a public component each of our meetings, both public and confidential, and we've been doing those by Zoom, as most commissions are doing these days, and that public meeting is available to anybody. So even when you're done with session, if you'd like to attend one of our regular meetings outside the disciplinary hearing, we can arrange that easily.
Absolutely. I think the Judiciary Committee would be very, very interested in that taking place. And we have got three more testifiers online. So we're going to go ahead and move to Fritz Pettyjohn.
Madam Chairman, Senators, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I'm a member of the Alaska Bar Association. I have been for 47 years. And I'd like to address the question asked by Senator Schauer, the sponsor of the bill, about why the Alaska Bar
Association. Mr. Pettyjohn? I forgot to say, please state your name for the record, and you've got a maximum of 3 minutes, okay?
Thanks. That's all I'll need. My name is Fritz Pettyjohn. I'm a former member of the legislature and a member of the Bar Association since 1974. And the question is, why does the Alaska Bar Association have control over the judicial system of the state of Alaska? And the answer is, as I suggest, that the lawyers who wrote this constitution were feathering their own nest, and they were making sure that they had control over the branch of government in which they made their living. And it has been proven to be a very profitable arrangement ever since. There is no reason why one professional association should have control over a branch of government other than the fact that they just exercise their political power to get it. Now, this bill is an advancement. It's an improvement on the situation, and I commend the sponsor for introducing it and the committee for hearing it. But if you're really going to address this issue, you've got to address the constitutional dimension here by amendment. And if that cannot be done through the legislature, it has to be done through a constitutional convention. I encourage all of you to take that option seriously. That's all I have for today. It's been a pleasure listening to you all. It brings back many memories. Mm-hmm. Served on the Senate Judiciary myself almost 40 years ago. And I think you're all doing a great job. And happy Valentine's Day to the chair and to Senator Hughes. And best wishes to the rest of you.
Okay. Thank you for being with us today, Fritz Pettyjohn. Thank you very much. Next, we're going to move to Linda Holmes-Prom. Please state your name, and you've got 3 minutes.
Thank you. Again, my name is Linda Holmstrom, and I thank you, Madam Chair, and the senators for allowing me to speak today. I am just a private citizen. I'm a retired Air Force officer and school counselor. I have lived in Alaska since 1988, and I'm just concerned, as many of you are, as to what I am seeing happening. And I am in support of the Senate Bill 14, and I would personally like to thank Senator Schauer for sponsoring this bill. as you know, currently without SB 14, the governor can only fill vacancies of the Court of Appeals and District Courts by selecting a judge from a small list submitted to him or her by the Alaska Judicial Council. And with the passing of the SB 14, the governor would be given the opportunity to select any attorney that meets the legal qualification. So this allows elected officials that are appointed by residents of Alaska to be given a voice rather than unelected members of the Alaska Judicial Council. The Alaska residents need to have a voice in this process, and SB 14 gives them that voice. I was going to end there, but I've had the opportunity to listen to people. Hopefully I'm saying the correct names. But when Susan spoke, and she spoke several times, and the operative word was nonpartisan. When Nancy spoke, she said, our judges are nominated, and they are not by a political affiliation because that they don't want the political affiliation to impact their decision. What I'm hearing today is our concern about the integrity of the judicial system. Our concern is that we are not seeing the nonpartisan approach. We are seeing where there is political activism, and it's a very big concern for the people of Alaska. We are looking for, we thank you for what you're doing. We thank you for SB 14. I think SB 14 could be an answer to this issue. And I just wanted to voice my concern and my appreciation for what you're doing.
Thank you, Linda, for being with us today, and we appreciate your testimony. Mario Bird was next, and I think he just dropped off the line. I don't think he's available anymore, so we're going to need to either get written testimony potentially from him. Kenneth Jacob is next, and then Senator Schauer will have a moment to make a final comment. So with that, Kenneth Jacobs, please state your name, and you've got...
Okay. My name is Ken Jacobus. Some of you know me. I've been an attorney in Alaska for over 50 years, and I've watched this process really very carefully. And I've seen it improve, by the way, over the years. The problems have been resolved, and I think it's the best now that it's ever been. But there are problems with it. But one of the things I don't think you – I've got 3 points only. One of them is don't separate – or don't try to move the admission function or the choice of – choice of the judges over to the Judicial Conduct Commission. Judicial Conduct Commission deals with the judges once they're on the bench. That just confuses the whole system. That's perfect the way it is. Second thing is that what I think should be added, and I've always thought about this, is go through the entire process as it is, but then add legislative approval of the final person who's selected at the end of it, like they do in the federal system. You've got to get the Congress to approve the judges who are elected in the federal system, have the legislature in joint session approve the judges who are selected with our system, which is a fine system. Let's see now, the third thing, third thing is that I looked at the statutory language, and there's a provision in there that says the Judicial Council may submit to the governor the name of a candidate only if the Judicial Council determines that the judicial candidate understands and is committed to strict constitutional interpretation of statutes and regulations and adhering to legislative intent. I think that needs to be taken out because you don't want to set up political standards for what the judge is going to decide, and especially since how a statute or a regulation is to be interpreted is not necessarily under strict scrutiny. And anyway, that's bad. You can't select a person unless the person's beliefs are a certain way or he's going to construe the law in a certain way. That's not our job to tell the judge what he's supposed to do, what sort of decisions are supposed to be made when they're on the bench. And the final thing is Fritz Pettijohn is right, that it's most important to have these the legislative oversight over appointments to the Superior Court and the Supreme Court. So you need a constitutional amendment. Anyway, and I'd be happy to assist or answer any questions, but those are my comments. I've been thinking about it for over 50 years, and I've actually been through the process myself, and my former wife, Sheree Jacobus, has been through the process. Anyway.
Okay. Well, Ken, thank you for your testimony. You got 3 seconds left. We don't have time for questions. I have promised Senator Schauer a final comment right now. So, Senator Schauer, please proceed.
Thank you, Senator Reinbold. And, Ken, I would love to talk to you about that because I'm open to change. I don't think we necessarily get it all right the first time. That's why the process is designed to work. So I'm very open to that and happy to make those, perhaps all those changes. Senator Reinbold, thanks for the opportunity. 30 seconds or so. I want to just highlight that many of the speakers, including one of our committee member colleagues, pointed out very eloquently that the Constitution was framed. It's been vetted. It's really, really good, to use the words of a former president. And it is a well-vetted document that everybody seems to understand and like how it's written and the authority that it gives, and it's in good shape. And my point to that is it also, if that's the case, and that's what they truly believe, as the court's representative and others today, that the Constitution is good, then that means the authority that the framers intended for the legislature to be able to assert, which is what we're doing here with legislative oversight, should also be good. And I am confused at why they continue to say the Constitution is good, well written, it makes sense, but yet we can't make the changes that those very same framers allowed, as Fritz Pettijohn pointed out, to assert as the legislative super branch, or the super branch, the legislature, to have that oversight as the overall voice of the people. So I just want to make that comment. Senator Reinbold, thank you for the testimony today and for the chance to talk. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Vice Chair Schauer, we appreciate this. And as the bill sponsor, thank you for your comments. They're very important. We have passed the deadline to get out of this room at this point, so I'm going to go ahead and make an announcement. We've definitely slowed this bill down quite a bit, and I am going to ask for amendments to be due by Tuesday at 5 p.m. for Senate Bill 14, and we're going to keep public testimony open, and I want to remind people that they can submit testimony, even anybody who testified today, but sjud@akledge.gov, sjud@akledge.gov. And I've talked about amendments. We're going to be dealing with amendments on this next week, and we will be meeting Monday, February 15th at 1:30. We will be considering the governor's appointee for the State Commission on Human Rights, William Craig, and then continue in regards to this bill. I know we also have a history of pandemics on Wednesday, next Wednesday, and I believe we have UAA, Tom Hennessy, talking about the model that the disaster declaration was built upon next Friday. I'm going by memory right now. With that, we're going to go ahead and gavel out, and I wish everybody a wonderful weekend, and we are gaveling out at 3:04 p.m.